It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if they're special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Let's have a conversation and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. Each of you, you're treasured, you're valued, you have a purpose. Strive for excellence, live with intention, and take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. Thank you to this great team I work with. That's producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, Charlie, and all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting. It is a great day to be alive, producer Steve.
Yeah, and no shortage of things to be discussing today, whether you're pro or con. It's a good day. At least it's not Monday.
Yes, and we're moving towards Friday. You're one of your favorite days, but a lot to talk about. Special show today. This show today is brought to you by the Harris family, and we're going through the Revolutionary War. Ben Martin is a patriotic historian. He's a West Point grad. He is a former Army Ranger. And he's bringing these men and women, this whole thing alive. And we'll be talking with him in segments 2, 3, and 4. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. And you can find the recaps of the shows there in the podcasts. And sign up for our weekly newsletter. You'll get first look at all of the upcoming guests, our most recent podcasts, our most recent op-eds, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to each and every one of you who are contributing to keep our independent voice on the air as we look at these issues, freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something is a good idea, you should not have to force people to do that. And one of my great sponsors for this show is Castlegate Knife and Tool. They are a family-owned business in Sedalia, Colorado. They have knives from the best blade makers from throughout the world. They have probably the most extensive knife collection west of the Mississippi River. And so I'd recommend that you go out and go down to Sedalia. It's just such a little taste of Americana. And, of course, there's some great restaurants down there as well. Or you can go to castlegate.com to check out everything also. That's castlegate.com. And we look at these issues as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something is a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do it. And it's never compassionate to take other people's rights, their property, their freedom, or their livelihood via force, whether it's with a weapon, policy, unpredictable and excessive taxation, or fear. And Steve, when I wrote the copy for the promo this week, I intentionally put in there some of the things that the colonists were really frustrated with King George about. And that was excessive taxation, ever-encroaching rules and regulations, and sending swarming bureaucrats to control the colonists' lives. I see a lot of that happening these days, Steve.
Well, one of their things was taxation without representation. And, you know, I think everybody gets that. The funny thing, or the ironic thing, is now we have representation on paper, but there are too many days where I'm not sure who they're representing.
That is a good point. They're supposed to represent the people. And I no longer call them elected officials. They are elected representatives. And when we talk about the battle of the narrative, as we work to take back the word conservative, the conserve means to conserve this idea, this vision of the Declaration that all men are created equal with these rights from God of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And it's important as we go through this and take back these narratives that is really, really important. And I no longer call it a Democratic Party. It is the Democrat Party. And those are just small things, but they're important to remember. But let's go to our quote for today. It's from George Washington. He was an American political leader, military general, statesman, and founding father. He was the first president of the United States. He served from 1789 to 1797. And he also led the Patriot forces to victory in the War for Independence. He was born in 1732. He died in 1799. And this is what George Washington said. He said, "Government is not reason. It is not eloquent. It is force. like fire. It is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Experience has taught us that it is much easier to prevent an enemy from posting themselves than it is to dislodge them after they have got possession. And when the freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led, like sheep to the slaughter. Steve, when we see this assault on freedom of speech that is occurring, it's nothing new. If an idea can't stand up to the scrutiny of people being able to talk about it, and it has to be, and speech has to be shut down regarding that scrutiny, then we know that we are in a very, very dangerous situation, Steve.
Well, you know, it's not only is it the speech in discussing different ideas and whatnot, it's also just things that are actually happening within the culture. You know, case in point, Biden's kid and all his misadventures over the last several years, and how all the major media just suppress it, just shut it down. So it comes at you in many different forms.
Well, and people have a responsibility to search out truth, to search. And I know that with the mainstream media, that so many people are not looking at alternatives. And if you only watch the mainstream media, you certainly would have somewhat of a different view of what is really happening out there. But it's important that we continue to speak truth. My hope is through this show that we help you, the listener, get your brain around these issues so that you can engage with your friends and your family and your colleagues about these important issues and start to help them understand this as well. Let's run over here to the, there's a couple of bills of the day. And they're never innocuous. They may kind of look like it. One is a House Bill 21-1207, and it's overpayment of workers' compensation benefits. And apparently, if somebody has been overpaid, there may be instances with this law that the claimant can keep the overpayment. And first of all, if you're overpaid, you really, the honorable thing to do is to pay the money back. And if you realize you're being overpaid, you should obviously notify them as well. And that kind of goes back to the character of our nation. And here, this particular bill, House Bill 21-1207, it says, one of the last things on the summary says, prohibits the director of the division, of course that's all bureaucrats, of workers' compensation or an administrative law judge from reopening an award of benefits paid to a claimant due to an overpayment except in limited specific circumstances. Do you not find that? And the cost that this will have, again, it's taking money from the unemployment fund, which is already underwater, and allowing people to keep that extra money. I find that absolutely astounding, Steve.
One word, theft. When does it become theft?
It is. It's just legalized theft on that. The other one is Senate Bill 21-197. And basically, this provides that injured workers can search out their doctor. There's no limits on that. And I guess the prior practice is that there were four different choices that people could choose from. And what the concern is here is that maybe somebody that doesn't want to go back to work might go doctor shopping so that they could continue to receive this compensation and not have to go back to work. And a number of the business groups I believe that it'll open up the process to costly delays and potential doctor shopping among workers who don't want to be told to return to their jobs so soon. And again, there's so many different bills by these Democrats down at the State House that they look at employers as these very bad people, I think. One of the most compassionate things a person can do is to give another person a job. And so a person that goes out and creates a business, and the business is growing, and they need to hire employees to help them make that business grow. it really should be an honor to get to do that. But we've seen it in our colleges. We've seen it in our high schools now, that they look at business as bad. Well, business is really the engine that helps people live thriving, flourishing lives, Steve.
Well, in the pendulum, if that's the right, yeah, that's a good word picture. The pendulum in business, one side is small business, the other side is big business. What uh-huh. we're seeing is that definitely it's tipping towards big business in terms of their favor, getting their favor, and small business is being left out in the cold.
Well, and we saw that through the scamdemic as well. And when I call it the scamdemic, I'm not saying that there is not a COVID, a Wuhan, China virus. There is. And I know that it can be very serious. Remember, there are treatments. People forget that there are treatments. And I know of three different people that went to either the doctor or to the emergency room, and they sent them home with no treatments. And I find, and Dr. Jill and I have talked about that, and it's I'm just incredulous that that has happened. But when we look at what has happened during this scamdemic, big business and big government like each other, and big business can encourage big government to put in rules and regulations and policies that hurt small businesses. We saw the small businesses were shut down because of public policy. And I think part of that is to try to break the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people. And I believe we're coming back on that. Big business and big government like each other, and we need to make sure we keep our entrepreneurial, our small businesses in a position where they can thrive and prosper. One other thing, Steve, and that's what you wanted to get to here on the outline, and that is the census. Texas is to gain 2 House seats. New York and California are among the losers, and it is all blue states that I guess West Virginia, it's considered a blue state as well. I think it is. California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia all are set to lose 1 House seat in Congress. And then it was red states primarily where people are moving. The important thing is, if you are living in a state that you don't like the policies and you don't like the taxation, and you move to a state that you do like the policies and you do like the taxation, make sure you vote for the people that are protecting you from higher taxes and all those onerous policies. And again, we need to remember that we are 50 different states, 50 different petri dishes with different policies. And with what is happening, the federal government right now, states are going to need to be pushing back on all of these things. It's kind of like King George, what he was doing. We need to push back on that from a state. Each state, and here in Colorado, we need to work on election integrity, and we need to shed light on what's happening down at the state house, and we need to work to elect people that like lower taxes for everyday people and put in policies that help people thrive and prosper, and that is basically more freedom. Steve, your quick comment on that.
Well, you took some of my thunder there. There's two major things facing all the states, all 50 states, and election integrity is probably the most important. But right behind that is term limits to try and stop this incredible power grab that's going on right now.
You know, Steve, I am not a real term limits person. And the reason is because you can actually, I think it actually probably neuters your elected representatives even more, because the bureaucrats that are in charge of everything, they know that you're going to be termed out, you're going to be gone. So somebody that's doing a good job is going to be termed out. The American people need to start to really understand their elections. That's why we do our voter's guide. They need to understand the issues, and they need to start to do their civic duty. And so I know a lot of people are term limits supporters. I'm not. I really think that the term limits should be at the ballot box, and we need to clean up these elections. This whole mail-in ballot thing, it is just a tremendous opportunity where shenanigans can happen. And And so I do see that a little differently, but I know that a lot of people are real term limits people. Your quick comment.
Well, the burden of responsibility is in the electorate, and unfortunately the electorate has issues right now in terms of being informed. So yeah, they'll keep sending the wrong person back over and over again because they're not informed. And maybe that's, you know, what term limits is all about, is just trying to overcome that problem in the culture. But we all watched Ted Kennedy, you know, the lion of the Senate. How many terms? Six-year terms. And it's like, what in the world is going on in Massachusetts? And you know,
but the thing about it is, with this big bureaucratic state, I don't think that you can have term limits on the elected representatives, the elected politicians, and not do something about all these bureaucrats that are embedded, that are living off the taxpayer, and many of them with very big salaries and pensions. And I think we have to look at both problems at the same time, not term limits by itself. But let's go to break, because we've got a big show planned for you today. And before we do that, Hooters Restaurant is another great sponsor of this show. They have five locations, and that is Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, Colorado Springs, and they have all kinds of specials. Tomorrow is Wednesday, and that is Wings Day, and you buy to-go or dine-in. You buy 20 wings, you get 10 for free, and actually, the girls are coming over tomorrow night, so I'm going to be ordering. There was a request for barbecue shrimp. I think I'm going to order that tomorrow, Steve, but let's go to break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Ben Martin about the Revolutionary War, the Southern Campaign. He brings the men and women of the Revolutionary War and the issues to life. We'll be right back.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
From north or south.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. And you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. On the line with me is Ben Martin. He is a patriotic historian, a former Army Ranger, graduated from West Point, has a deep love for our country. And he's the guy that taught me that liberty is the responsible exercise of freedom. And liberty was what the colonists were fighting for, the patriots were fighting for. And Ben Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kim. It's so good to be with you today. How are you?
I am well. I'm excited to jump into this. And I mentioned, I was at a meeting recently that Washington called the Revolutionary War, that the patriots wanting to get their freedom, our freedom from Britain, was the glorious cause. And that is, those words are just so wonderful, Ben. So we want to start about the glorious cause, though, and we're going to talk about the Southern Campaign. So where should we start?
Well, Kim, you're so right. And that glorious cause, he said that when he accepted the nomination, the unanimous nomination to make him the sink of the Continental Army. So yeah, you're right. It was just super. So today I'd like to start with a really quick recap of what we've done in the first quarter, and we'll go through this really quickly because we're now in the second quarter of 2021, and we've already covered lots of ground in the American Revolution during our first three sessions of the year. So to give everyone an appreciation of what we have covered together, so that we can do this as a starting point reference for the exciting topics which we're going to cover in the second quarter and in the second half of the year later on. In our first session this year, we described the precursors to the Revolutionary War, and the biggest of these was the French and Indian War, which cost Britain considerable capital and ended the salutary neglect policies that they had previously exercised with us. Now they were demanding we pay taxes to the British government without having any representative voice in that government. This resulted in many confrontational incidences in America, such as the various British tax acts of the 1760s and 70s, the Boston Massacre of 1770, the Boston Tea Party of 1773, the Intolerable Acts of 1774, the occupation of Boston by a goodly portion of the British Army in North America, and finally, a violent clash of arms as the British Army went out into the Massachusetts countryside and instigated the battles of Lexington and Concord in April 1775, and then the Battle of Breed's Hill, Bunker Hill, in June of that same year.
So, okay, now, hey, Ben, just a quick question. When we're looking at the policies of the Harris-Biden administration right now and this exorbitant spending that is going on, and yes, in some ways we have elected people there, although we have all these questions about election integrity. But when we look at the policies of, and I mentioned, I don't know if you heard this in the promo that I did, I talked about the swarming bureaucrats that were coming out to harass the people and these policies. I see a correlation between what is happening in Washington now and what King George was doing to the people. Do you see that?
It's an absolute similarity, you know, if it ever could be one, so stark. And it says we're doing the same thing. We're doing just what happened then, and we're facing a population that has no say in what is happening, and they disagree vehemently with what is happening. And that's where we are right now. And we have to guard against that, and that's why our founders, our framers, developed the Constitution, the government that we have today. Is that there was always a chance that you could affect what the government was doing. That was our government. That government was put in place and empowered by us, the people. And when we no longer can make any changes or influence upon that government, this is what happens when you give the people no other choice. And so we have to take a lot of care in that. And our founders, our framers, did not want to ever come to that. That's why they installed this series of checks and balances. And it seems like we're moving away from those checks and balances. In fact, we're nullifying them. We're canceling them right now by our government. And that is creating a lot of frustration in the people.
Yes, definitely. And when Joe Biden, his first month, basically was doing executive order after executive order, that is not what we do in a representative government at all. So
absolutely.
Let's continue on, though, so so that we can get to the Southern campaign. I just think it's important that people understand that the policies are very similar.
Very similar.
King George was doing, what's happening in Washington now.
And that's right. And he's just shutting the people out of any form of influence upon the government. And that was back then when they had the divine right of kings, and we as a country changed that for not only ourselves, but for the whole world. And we denied that there was a divine right of kings, and we said that the power in a government comes from the consent of the people. The just power of the government is an exact quote from our Declaration of Independence. And that is not happening right now. And that is something that our founders guarded against because they didn't want our government being torn asunder by anarchy from a frustrated people. And so we talk here, we finished with what was happening at Breed's Hill in Bunker Hill in June of 1775. And then in that the first three sessions, we described the forming of the Continental Army and the selection of George Washington as the sink of that army when he uttered those wonderful words of the glorious cause. And his selection of leadership from and for that army, where he went into Boston, have all the collection of the militias that had come to Boston, and he went in there and chose the leadership that he knew was important for the army that was going to face the British army. And then that army laid siege to Boston, and the reason they did that was to keep the British army from going out of Boston and wreaking havoc in the Massachusetts countryside. And then at the start of 1776, George Washington drastically changed the army's main objective in Boston from confining the British army within Boston to expelling them from Boston. And Colonel Henry Knox hatched a plan that successfully, almost miraculously, retrieved a great supply of cannon from Fort Ticonderoga, and the army furtively emplaced them on Dorchester Heights, and we talked about that in our last session, which forced the British army out of Boston and on to Halifax, Nova Scotia, in March of 1776. And you have to, I hope you have to agree with me that that's quite a bit of ground that we covered in only three sessions this year.
It really is. And my favorite pencils that I use are Ticonderoga. Yeah. And I thought, okay, I know about that battle now. Hey, Ben, let's go to break. And
sure.
We've got Jason McBride with Presidential Wealth Management on the line. I know, Jason McBride, that you love it when Ben Martin is on the show.
I always like to listen to Ben. It's almost like you were right there.
I know it. And so we're going to jump back into the Southern campaign here. What is happening over in your world?
Well, Kim, the markets continue to try to move higher. You know, recently, as we've talked about a few times, the NASDAQ was under some pressure and the tech stocks had hit some selling, but boy, they've certainly recovered most of that. Yesterday, the NASDAQ moved up about 120 points. It's now very, very close to its all-time highs again, so it's only a few points off of that. So when you look across the markets now at the NASDAQ, the Dow, the S&P, the small caps, they all seem to be moving pretty much in unison and continuing to try to move up higher. So, Kim, I don't know if that's because they're still expecting a lot more stimulus. I certainly don't believe it's because the markets think that a higher corporate tax rate is a good idea. So it still feels a bit tenuous to me, but the old saying is don't fight the trend because the trend is your friend.
Well, and one thing that people might consider doing is a Roth account, a Roth IRA, and that is go ahead and pay taxes on this now because it looks like taxes are going to be higher, and get that over into a Roth account. And you can transfer the security. You don't have to sell it, right?
That's correct, Kim. When you do a conversion from your traditional IRA to a Roth, you can do any amount of your choosing. And you're right, Kim. If you own stocks, you don't have to sell them. You can just move the stocks from the traditional IRA over to the Roth. And again, you can move part of the stock, all of the stock. You just got to figure out what dollar amount you want to pay the taxes on now. And then you go from there on what you actually move from the IRA to the Roth.
Well, it may be a great strategy for people. I'd recommend that they sit down with you and just kind of go through a discovery session. Knowledge is power. How can people reach you?
Best way, Kim, is just give us a call. That's 303-694-1600. That's 303-694-1600. Kim, we're open for business, face-to-face. Wear a mask if you like. If you don't want to, you don't have to. That's called freedom, and that's what I believe in when people come to see me.
Well, that's for sure. Again, Jason, thanks so much. And we're going to continue on our conversation with Ben Martin on our American freedom. So we will talk to you tomorrow.
Have a great show, Kim.
Sounds great. We'll be right back with Ben Martin.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute, to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I'm Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. And you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. And thank you to each and every one of you who are contributing to keep our independent voice on the air as we kick the tires on all of these ideas out there. This is such a special show. It's brought to you by the Harris family. Thank you to them for this. And Ben Martin is a patriotic historian. He is a former Army Ranger, West Point graduate. And he has a great love for our American idea, our American experiment. And we're talking about the Revolutionary War this year. We hope that you are learning a lot from this. Ben Martin, where do we go from here in the second segment, or the third segment? Excuse me.
Okay, Kim.
Goes
no
quickly.
Problem. Get that Fort Ticonderoga pencil out there. We'll get it.
Yeah, there you go.
So next we're going to talk about two of the dilemmas, the decision time for George Washington. At the conclusion of the Boston campaign, like I said, there was decision time for our commander-in-chief. And now that Washington and the Continental Army had forced the Brits out of Boston, it presented another dilemma. Where will the British strike next? The British have almost complete naval superiority in the North American seas, which not only allows them to dominate the North American seas, but also commerce and obviously military force. It allows them to move their forces much more rapidly in this North American theater. Therefore, the American army, which can only move by foot on the ground, must anticipate the next moves of the British, or they will get there after they can influence any kind of military force. So with the aids of councils of war, the knowledge of past British actions, and good military intelligence, George Washington and his staff decide that the next major military objective of the British forces will be the New York City area. They cannot be sure, but luckily they have decided correctly. So now General Washington must move his army from Boston to New York City. The only option for doing this is overland and by foot, as we talked about. The distance is 200-plus miles over less than optimal roads and trails. So they get moving, and they arrive in New York City in April of 1776. And then they get there, and then the next decision is to plan and prepare for battle that they assume will come. It's sooner than probably later. And as the American forces arrive in New York City, they begin to do a military analysis of the terrain there. Immediately, they face other big decisions. What will be their plan for defense of New York City? Where will the British attack? So New York is surrounded by navigable waterways. The East River, runs along the east side of Manhattan and separates it from Long Island. The Hudson River runs along the west side of Manhattan and separates it from Staten Island and New Jersey. So the British superiority and naval power is a great advantage in this area, in the New York City area, even more so than it was in the Boston area. They can go, they meaning the British, can go just about anywhere with considerable military forces and get there much quicker than can the American forces repositioning their forces over land. And any spot along either side of Manhattan can be reached faster by the British naval ships than by American forces traveling by foot. So do the Americans concentrate their smaller forces on Manhattan or Long Island? Both locations can be effectively attacked amphibiously. And if the Patriots concentrate their forces on Manhattan and the British attack Long Island, the Americans will not be able to reinforce or even move their forces across the East River to get there to help, because the British naval forces will control the waters. And the same principles apply, and the same British advantage exists if the American defenses are concentrated on Long Island and the Brits attack primarily Manhattan. So in making,
Well, Ben, just a couple of questions, and there were not as nearly as many patriots in Washington's army as what the British didn't. The British have a much larger force.
The British had a much larger force, and we're going to talk about that in great detail in our next session next month when we actually talk about the battles for the New York City area, all the battles that happened during that time. So,
and
right
one other
now,
question. Yeah. This is happening before the Declaration of Independence, right?
Correct. I mean, yes. They arrived there. They pushed the British out of Boston in March, and they arrive with their forces in April of 1776. And they have from April until whenever the battles are supposed to start. There's no timetable for when they're supposed to start. We know now that they start in August of 1776. So they have from really that part, from the latter parts of April until August before the battle starts. So they have to prepare. Okay. But even before they prepare, they have to decide where they're going to put their defenses. Because, as you'd already mentioned, the American forces will have less force, less soldiers, less cannon, less everything than the British have in there as they come as the attackers. And so once the Americans establish where they're going to put their defenses, they can't move them laterally or in internal lines of communication, is what we say in the military. They can't move them because water interrupts or creates obstacles between their moving laterally to these different positions. So they have to do the analysis correctly and make the right decisions before the British Army ever gets there and attacks. And so in making these plans for defense of New York City, George Washington has selected General Charles Lee, a former officer in the British Army and one of his most experienced subordinate leaders, to lead the effort to make these plans. And he quickly reaches the conclusion, he meaning, again, General Lee, reaches the conclusion that a city surrounded by water is almost impossible to properly defend because of the power of the British Navy and the inability of the Americans to do anything to stop it. And his quote is, "Whomever commands a sea must command the town." Still, Lee developed a plan that called for a series of fortifications at key points, and Washington accepted it. But after he accepted this plan and Lee was to put it into action, Congress then sent Lee to Charleston, South Carolina, which is what we're going to talk about next.
Jeez. Okay. And a quick question on this, because you said that in many of these decisions, they were the correct decisions. Don't you think that's where divine providence had his hand on the American founding?
I really think that's true, Kim. I've thought that forever, ever since I first learned about these battles and all of the great things that happened. Benjamin Franklin talked about that quite a bit when we were meeting for the Constitutional Convention, too. And many of the other founders acknowledged that. And we will see great examples of that in the next session that we cover when we talk about New York City's campaign and then the campaign through New Jersey. So, yeah, okay. there were some great providential, guidance here.
Okay. Hey, Ben Martin, let's do this. Let's go to break early so that I don't interrupt this Southern campaign. We're going to be going into our last segment. This always goes by so quickly. I'm talking with Ben Martin, patriotic historian and former Army Ranger, West Point grad, and he has this love of our American history, brings it alive. So we're going to go to break, and we'll be right back.
Controlling your own destiny. There are a lot of unknowns on the horizon with the new administration. Predovich and Company is here to help. Trusted professionals for all your bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting needs. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich and Company. They've been helping her for years. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich and Company works with clients from anywhere in the United States. Give them a call at 303-791-3000 to put Predovich and Company to work for you. Call 303-791-3000 today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to each and every one of you who contribute to keep our independent voice on the air. On the line with me is Ben Martin. We're talking about the Patriots, the Revolutionary War, and the Southern Campaign. And you said that, now, was it Congress or Washington who sent Major General Charles Lee to Charleston?
It was actually Congress. You know, George Washington, and the Congress is going to do this a couple times for the Southern campaign. One of those, we'll talk about the Battle of Camden, when they send General Gates down to take command of the Southern theater, and that is in direct opposition. Washington actually makes his choice of General Greene to send down there, and Congress will send down General Gates, which will create a total disaster down there. And eventually, General Greene, Washington's first choice, will go down there to successfully conduct that campaign. But right now, they're sending down General Lee, and they have a great deal of respect. Many of the people in the Army have a great deal of respect for General Lee, but as we see in later presentations that I make, General Lee will lose his credibility with George Washington and with Congress. So right now, they're giving him a lot of credibility, which he will destroy.
Okay. So what happens?
So anyway, they send him down there after he has come up with this plan to fortify and defend New York City. And, of course, that doesn't make General Washington happy, but General Washington is the ultimate team player, and he does what Congress tells him to do. And it sets a great example for the military that is to follow in George Washington's footsteps. So they go down, and this is the first real major British campaign in the South. Before that, it's been conducted by partisan loyalists down there in that area, in South Carolina, North Carolina, in Georgia. And so now it's going to be where the British are going to send their forces down there to conduct their first campaign. And this campaign will be conducted in the Charleston, South Carolina area, and it's called the Battle of Sullivan Island, which is also known as the Battle of Fort Sullivan, and it's also sometimes called the First Siege of Charleston, owing to a more successful bridge siege that will happen in 1780. And that's the one we'll talk about when we get to that point. So in early 1776, the British organized an expedition for operations in the southern colonies, but they were delayed by logistical concerns, bad weather, and the American attack upon Canada at the time in Montreal. So the expedition didn't reach the north coast of North Carolina until May of 1776. And the British general Henry Clinton, who we talked about before in the Siege of Boston, and Admiral Sir Peter Parker, also of British Navy, found the North Carolina conditions unsuitable for their operations and decided instead to act against Charleston, South Carolina. And they arrived there in early June of 1776. And the British troops were landed on a place called Long Island, and we don't want to confuse that with the Long Island of New York City, and so it was also called the Isle of Palms, to kind of keep this clear, but it was called Long Island down in South Carolina. And it was near Sullivan's Island where Colonel William Moultrie, a great patriot of the Revolutionary War, commanded a partially constructed fort in preparation for a naval bombardment and land assault by these British forces. And Major Charles Lee, who we just talked about, was sent down there to command the Southern Continental Theater of War, and he would provide supervision for the construction of this fort on Sullivan Island called Fort Sullivan at the time. And the American chose Sullivan Island at that time because it was a geographic obstacle that shielded the harbor, the South Carolina, the Charleston Harbor. A large vessel sailing into Charleston first had to cross the Charleston Bar. And that's not a legal thing. That's a sandbar in the actual channel. And a series of submerged sandbars that were lying about 8 miles southeast of the city. So Colonel Moultrie and his 2nd South Carolina Regiment, which were militia people, arrived at the island in March of 1776, just a couple of months before the British got there. And they began construction of a fort to defend the island and the channel to Charleston Harbor. The construction moved slowly, but during late May, the British frigates arrived to scout the area before the forces got there and observed the construction of the American fort on Sullivan Island. The main British fleet arrived outside of that Charleston Harbor on 1 June of 1776.
So in the fort, did they have cannon? Did they have plenty
of... Yeah, they had some cannon, but they were greatly outgunned. So Moultrie observed all these scout boats from the British that were checking out what he was doing. And some of them were just a few hundred yards from the fort. Major Lee, the commander of the South Carolina troops, arrived a few days later after 1 June and was put in command of the American land forces around Charleston. So on 8 June, after most of the British fleet had crossed the bar that we're talking about, those sandbars anchored, they anchored off in this place called the Five Phantom Hole, which was sort of a deep area in the channel. And Major Clinton sent a proclamation to the Americans demanding they lay down their arms or face military action, which John Rutledge, who we will talk about, he was a political leader in South Carolina, will eventually become governor, but he's also one of our framers and our founders. And so he flatly rejected that demand. And with that, with the fort on Sullivan Island only half complete, British Admiral Parker, who was the command of the naval forces for the British operation, was confident his British warships would blast that incomplete fort into pieces. And the Fort Sullivan was a square-shaped fort, and it was made up of the completed only one wall, and that was the wall that was towards the sea. So this wall was made of palmetto logs and were 16 feet wide and filled with sand. That was the wall that protected them, the only one wall of the fort. And it rose 10 feet above the wooden platforms for the artillery. And they also hastily erected a palisade of thick planks to protect the powder magazines. And there's unfinished other walls to the fort. So it was only one wall there. And an assortment of, they had, and you asked about the cannon, they had 31 hard-to-get cannons, ranging from 9 and 12 pounds up to 18 and 26 pounds. And they dot it. But remember, there were only 31 of those. The British fleet, in comparison, had 9 man-of-war ships, with the flagship being the 50-gun HMS Bristol, as well as many ships of the line, all mounting nearly to 300 heavy cannon on the British naval side versus the 31 cannons in the fort.
Oh,
pretty
man.
Big. That's a 10-to-1. It's a 10-to-1 advantage. So Clinton, Major General Clinton, the commander of land forces, landed most of his troops on the nearby Long Island, or what we call the Island of Palms, to differentiate, to attack Sullivan from the rear during the upcoming naval attack. So Clinton had landed this British amphibious forces on that Long Island with the intention of crossing the shallow sandbars and attacking from the other side of the island, basically coming in from the rear. So it was going to be a pincer move. The naval forces were going to be attacking the fort from the front, and then the land forces would be attacking it from the rear. So, but again, meaning the British commanders, relied on poor reconnaissance, which reported that an assault could easily cross those sandbars. The men could wade across from the Island of Palms, and so they searched for that shallow ford, which everybody kept saying. They searched several days and nights, and they yielded no possible route for an attack. The water was too deep there. They had been told that they could walk across easily, but that was not true. And so the British were thus forced to watch Colonel William Thompson, who was a subordinate commander of Colonel Moultrie, and his Americans prepare a formidable position to defend that extremity of the island. So while Major General Clinton continued his fruitless search, the last two British ships, the HMS Bristol and the HMS Experiment, had, just like the other ones, had to remove some of their guns to lighten the boats enough to clear the sandbars. And so the battle begins, and instead of having 300 cannons, they only have 270 versus 31
okay.
But this is the other thing. Those cannons that the Americans had only had 28 rounds for each of their guns. For this major battle. For this reason, Colonel Moultrie ordered his men to wait 10 minutes between firing each round and to concentrate only on the ships nearest the fort. The British fleet, as we talked about, had those 20 ships and 9 of the big ships, the men of war, and the entire fleet had a total, as we said before, now instead of 300 guns, they had 270 guns. And so, but they relied, the British relied on pilots to guide the ships through the channel who had been impressed into service. But, and they were probably Americans that were loyal to the Patriot cause. And the pilots were ordered to bring the first ships to anchorage close enough to the fort so that others could anchor very near there also. The battle plan called for them to sally by the forts and fire at the forts to destroy them. And it was unbelievable. So the battle begins. The tide immediately began to turn against the British, literally, the tide. The pilots refused to bring the warship in as close as Admiral Parker ordered, for they feared running aground. The full effect of their gunnery, which the British fleets were capable of bringing to bear, was lost. Those sallies that were planned, which to exploit the unfinished sides of the fort, failed, and the tide changed, and the ships ran aground on the shoal. In the meantime, the inexperienced gunners, that was the other thing that the Americans had, they had inexperienced gunners in the Palmetto forts who had been trained as infantrymen, but they were pouring a deadly fire into the British fleet and demonstrating courage and ardor uncommon in green troops. The fire had a terrible effect on the British ships. And every person on the quarterdeck of the HMS Bristol, which was a flagship, were killed or wounded. And this included the wounding of Lord William Campbell, the South Carolina's royal governor, as well as Admiral Parker, the head of the Navy fleet there, who was also wounded. And one of those wounds was by splinters, which tore off his pants and wounded his knee. So the British continued their bombardment to little effect because of the fort's construction of palmetto leaves, logs. And that's why the palmetto tree is on the British, on the South Carolina flag today. Palmetto is a soft and spongy, simply absorbed the cannonballs. Meanwhile, the Americans expended roughly 1/7 of the amount of powder that the British did, but the slow and steady fire from the Americans was quite accurate. And the British also attempted an assault, as I said, from Long Island by small boats on Colonel Thompson's men that we talked about earlier on the northern end of the Sullivan Island. The attack was covered by an American-British schooner to help give them support. The boats were turned back when the Americans fired at point-blank range. And we don't talk about that too much, but there were many American riflemen that were part of Thompson's men, and they fired very accurately at the troops that were coming on in those small barges to attack Thompson's men. And with this rebuff, Colonel Clinton called off the attack, and no other attempts were made. And by 21:30 hours, 9:30 that evening, all firing had ceased. And by 11:30, 23:30 that night, the British ships withdrew to that Five Phantom Hole, the deep part of the channel that we talked about before. And so the aftermath of all of that, Kim, was the result of that victory was manifold for the Southern Patriots. It was their first decisive victory. And for South Carolina, it produced a confidence in the government that was led by John Rutledge that we talked about.
Oh, my gosh. Ben, we are out of time on this, but we indeed stand on the shoulders of giants. Ben Martin, thank you so much for joining us. And our quote for today goes to George Washington. And he said, "Firearms stand next in importance to the Constitution itself." My friends today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America. Climbing, twisting, turning further from my home. Young, like a new moon rising, fierce through the rain and lightning, wandering out into this great unknown. And I don't want no one to cry, but tell them if I don't survive.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
KLZ AM HD Denver, the source AM and FM. AM 560 and 100.7 FM. 560thesource.com.